This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The business world is talking about how to make the American corporation more competitive. But Harvard economist Robert Reich says we're worrying about the wrong issue. In the era of the multinational, keeping the American corporation more competitive isn't necessarily going to improve either the health of the American economy or the standard of living of the average American. Reich is an influential liberal economist who consults to corporations and Democratic congressmen. He advised Michael Dukakis during his presidential campaign. Reich says if you want to boost the American economy, don't fool yourself about buying American, buying one of our products. Who is us in the world of multinationals where American companies move manufacturing plants to other parts of the world, while Japanese companies open plants here that train and employ Americans?
Well, here's a good example. If you wanted to buy an American-made automobile this year, your chance of doing that is probably greater if you buy a Honda than if you buy a Pontiac Le Mans. A Pontiac Le Mans is design-engineered in Germany. It's assembled from parts made in Korea, in Mexico. There are a lot of other nationals that are involved in Pontiac Le Mans, and so that if you really are intent on getting an American car that is made by Americans, you do probably better by buying a Honda, many of which now are made in the United States. In fact, in a very few years, and I wouldn't be surprised if by next year, the number three American automaker, and I'm talking about American automaker in terms of where things are made and by whom they are made, will be Honda, not Chrysler. Chrysler is making more and more outside the country, relying on Mitsubishi for parts and for small cars. Chrysler is not any longer going to be a major American automobile company. You see, they are coming here, we are going there. Who is us? Us are Americans. We are Americans, American workers. We are adding value. We are doing, some of us are doing quite well, some of us are not doing quite well, but American competitiveness has to be equated not with the profitability of American-owned companies, but with the value that we as Americans add.
Now, this gets a little confusing because, for instance, don't you have to ask which company has American interests more at heart? Is it a Japanese auto company that has a large branch in America that's employing a lot of Americans? Or is it an American headquartered company that has a lot of branches in other parts of the world? You know, will either have a better impact on us?
Well,
you know,
I would say neither of them has American national interests at heart. Uh-huh. Both of those companies are trying to maximize shareholder value. Both of those companies, the Japanese company that's here and the American company that's over there, both of them are trying to make profits. If it comes to sacrificing profits for the sake of a nation, well, they're not going to do that. If an American company tried to sacrifice its shareholders' profits for the sake of doing something that the managers of that company thought was in the best interests of the United States, those shareholders would have a right to be pretty angry. They would probably, well, they might mount a breach of fiduciary duty litigation against the managers. There might be a takeover by a company or investors that were less, shall we say, patriotic. More interested in maximizing shareholder returns. There's also the question about whether American managers really are competent to decide what is in the national interest if they are departing from what is in the shareholders' interests. What you've seen over the last 15 years is American companies gradually bailing out of America. American automobile companies closing down plants and increasingly setting up factories abroad. Textile manufacturers, steel manufacturers, consumer electronics manufacturers, computers and so forth. Here's a Trivial Pursuit question, Terry. Maybe you can answer this.
No, probably what, not. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you try. Now, what's the major employer, a company that is the number one employer in Singapore?
I guess 10 points. Okay, wait. I'd guess some kind of clothing company. American-based or something, no?
The number one employer in Singapore is General Electric.
Uh-huh.
Here's another one for you.
Okay.
You were in the right track on that one. I'll give you 3 points. The major exporter of computers from Japan.
Huh. Does Sony make computers?
no, you don't get any points on that one at all. It's IBM.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
One of the three largest semiconductor manufacturers, you know, little semiconductor chips, you know, those little fingernail-sized chips that have all those integrated circuits on them.
Yeah.
The number two or three semiconductor manufacturer in Japan, well, any guesses?
No, go ahead.
Texas Instruments. The point is that American companies are all over the world, some of them doing very, very well, many of them exporting from foreign platforms back to the United States. Last year, about 20% of our trade imbalance with Taiwan was really American companies making things there and sending them back to the United States. And if you look at research and development expenditures, well, American companies are increasing the amount of foreign R&D that they are financing at a much faster pace than they are increasing the amount of American-based research and development that they're undertaking. And meanwhile, of course, foreigners are coming here like mad, setting up everything from computer and semiconductor manufacturing plants to automobile factories. There's even a major employer of custodial help that happens to be a Belgian company employing something like 40,000 Americans right now inside the United States. Again, my point, let's not any longer look at the nationality of corporate ownership, because money is going all over the world. Americans own pieces of foreign companies. Foreigners own pieces of American companies. Capital is now global and highly mobile. The real issue is which nation's people are adding what value to the world economy? Who knows how to do what? Where are global corporations locating their plants and equipment and their what I call high value added, their most sophisticated kind of research, development, fabrication facilities, so that the nation's people get the kind of training they need to add further value in the years ahead?
My guest is Robert Reich, an economist who teaches political economy and management at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's also the chairman of the editorial board of the new Journal of Liberal Economic Thought called American Prospect. Listen, before I ask you the next question, I want to know if I get a consolation prize for doing so abysmally on your little game of Trivial Pursuit. What do I get?
Well, you get an opportunity to play the game again.
Hey, lucky me. Okay.
Small while.
So where do you stand then on the question of free trade versus protecting U.S. industry?
Well, I don't buy into that kind of choice. I don't think that's the realistic choice. I think that everybody these days wants to avoid the term protectionist. Even a presidential candidate in 1988 who blamed the Japanese and blamed the South Koreans, when people accused him of being protectionist, he said, no, I'm not a protectionist. Nobody these days wants to be a protectionist. But by the same token, there is no longer any such thing as free trade. Free trade is an absolute, well, it's a myth. There is no free trade. Every government manages trade to the extent that every government is in the business of subsidizing research and development, of encouraging the adjustment of their workforce into higher skilled areas, to the extent that every government is engaged in what might be called non-tariff barriers, very subtle regulatory barriers. Well, the United States is no better than any other country in this regard. We tend to be a little bit hypocritical. We tend to accuse other nations of tipping the playing field in their direction. You've heard this expression, all we want is a level playing field.
Mm-hmm.
Well, take a very close look at that playing field. You'll see, for example, that in the United States, one out of every $3 spent by corporate America last year on research and development actually came from Uncle Sam, came from the federal government. Or if you're talking about protectionism, non-tariff barriers, well, look at what the Federal Communications Commission just did a while back, last year, with regard to high-definition television standards. The Japanese wanted to sell high-definition televisions in the United States, and as I said before, a lot of Americans are making high-definition televisions under the Sony label, but they can't sell them in the United States because the Federal Communications Commission said, no, we want a standard that is going to essentially protect the one remaining television manufacturer in the United States, American television manufacturer, and that is Zenith. And so we want a standard that is going to help Zenith get ahead in this game. Well, that's protectionism, plain and simple.
But, you know, there is this sense that even if there's a company headquartered in another country that's employing a lot of people through branches in the United States, that the profits are still going out of the country someplace else. Japan, well, products, if it's Sony, for instance.
Well, let's trace that through a little bit. Sony makes, let's say it makes camcorders in the United States. It's true that the profits from that go to Sony shareholders. Now, most of those Sony shareholders, it's true, are Japanese. But what about the returns to labor? Well, if Americans are making those Sony camcorders in the United States, Americans are getting the wages and the benefits. Also, we know, because we now have a lot of experience comparing Japanese employers to American employers within the United States, we know that Japanese employers are spending about $1,000 more per year on their American employees, training them, than American employers are spending on their American employees in terms of training. We also know that within any given industry, the Japanese employers of Americans are providing more job security and slightly higher wages and benefits than American employers of Americans are providing. We also know, and this is a very important thing in terms of building a workforce that can really compete in the future, we also know that the Japanese, in employing Americans in America, are helping Americans become much more productive and generate much higher quality products than American managers of Americans in the United States. Let me give you some examples. Bridgestone, which is a Japanese tire company, came in very recently and purchased Firestone tire manufacturing plants, essentially running the same plants now, have fixed up the plants, investing much more in those plants and equipment, running the same plants with the same American workers, but productivity is much higher and quality is much higher. Another example, Terry, Toyota came into the West Coast, took an ailing General Motors factory in Fremont, California, where absenteeism was very high, where the quality was very low, and it took essentially the same workforce, turned it around, much higher productivity, much higher quality. Well, it seems to me the proof is in the pudding. Americans are becoming better able to compete in the world with, in those instances, Japanese managers.
Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more about your views of the economy and the new global economy. My guest is Robert Reich. He's one of the country's leading liberal economists. He teaches political economy and in management at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And he's also the chairman of the editorial board of the new journal of liberal economic thought called American Prospect. This is Fresh Air. Economist Robert Reich is my guest. His latest book is called The Resurgent Liberal. Let's talk policy a minute. Do you think that America needs to adapt any kind of policy toward industrialization?
Yes, we need to. Other countries are. But the name of the game is very different from what it used to be. It is not us versus them in terms of American companies versus foreign companies. It's us versus them in terms of the American workforce and foreign workforces. The real central question is, how do you build the skills and capacities of Americans to add value to the world economy? Well, there's several ways I think you have to. The basics, of course, are education, training, education including preschool, even prenatal, postnatal care has some bearing on the capacity of Americans to add value and to be productive citizens in the future. Also, health care has a very important bearing on that. Now, in addition to those kinds of investments, we also have got to invest in research and development. We've got to help Americans get technological training on the job. How do we do that? Well, we might want to subsidize research and development like we do now. We may want to have consortia of companies that make things in America, help Americans understand how to do complicated technological things in the United States. But we are going about it a little bit the back doorway in a way that's not terribly effective right now. We are setting up consortia and subsidizing only American-owned companies. We're saying, for instance, there's a consortium of semiconductor manufacturers that is receiving federal money to help do cutting-edge research in Southern California. It's called Semitech. Only American companies can belong. But you see, that's silly, because most of the American members of Semitech are actually making their semiconductors, undertaking a lot of consumer electronic production outside the United States. They are global players. They take what they learn in Semitech and they move globally with it. What we ought to be saying to any global company, whether it's American-based or Japanese-based or German-based, we ought to say to these companies, look, we will subsidize you up to a certain extent. Of course, you have to be, it has to be on a matching basis. We're not going to take the full bill. But we'll provide you a little seed money, a little pump priming, if you come here and hire Americans and teach Americans how to do complicated things and hire Americans to do complicated things. But the condition is you got to do it here. You got to do research, development, engineering, applications engineering, manufacturing engineering, production right here in the United States if you want our R&D and applications engineering type subsidies.
But then, you know, if we're subsidizing the research and development of a company that's headquartered in another country, and the people in that country end up holding the patent or holding the innovation, aren't we really helping another country get ahead of us in what might be a future wartime economy or even in a peace economy? Aren't we giving another country the edge?
Well, that goes right back to the core question about what is the national interest and what does competitiveness mean? We used to think of the national interest and competitiveness in terms of the assets that we owned, the patents and the physical assets like plant and equipment, wherever on the earth we owned it, and we being Americans. I am suggesting to you that in the world ahead, in the global economy of the 21st century, what a nation's citizens own is going to be far less important than the skills that a nation's citizens have to continually innovate the next generations of technology. Patents, you see, become absolutely passé, obsolete within a very short time. The industry life cycle, the technological life cycle now in many high-tech areas is only 1 or 2 years. If you own a patent, no big deal. 2 years later, you're obsolete. The real wealth of a nation depends on what it is that the nation's people have in their heads, their capacities, their intellectual capacities and their skills, their accumulated experience to innovate in the future.
I understand what you're saying, but I have to ask you, when you find out, for instance, that Columbia has been bought out by Japanese-owned Sony, do you feel like there's anything that makes you a little bit queasy about that, or when you realize how much of the real estate in New York is owned by foreign interests? Does it make you at all uncomfortable?
But examine where the discomfort comes from. It doesn't make me uncomfortable. It makes me uncomfortable. I'll tell you what does make me uncomfortable. It makes me uncomfortable when I see that one out of every four American kids is functionally illiterate and doesn't graduate from high school. When I see that one out of every five kids under 6 years old is destitute, is actually impoverished. When we are not building up our human capital in the future, when we are spending less and less for infrastructure, for roads and bridges, when bridges are falling apart, when we are not investing in our future, that's what gets me uncomfortable. Whether the rights to The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy and Toto, are owned by Sony, I don't care who owns the rights to Dorothy and Toto. I would rather it be Americans, but it's no big deal. If Sony is coming here and paying Americans a lot of money to be actors and directors and producers in the future Wizard of Oz's, that's great. You know, Sony came over and bought CBS Records. Now that means that I think Madonna now works for CBS Records. Bruce Springsteen, does that mean, is Bruce Springsteen now working for the Japanese? Has Bruce Springsteen somehow a lost income? Is he now a slave of the Japanese? That's ridiculous. Bruce Springsteen is as valuable as he ever was. He has skills that the world wants. The fact that Sony is paying his salary makes no difference. He's going to make a fortune. American software engineers who are working for a German company or an American company, if they have skills, they're going to make a lot of money. It doesn't matter who you work for. The question is, what skills are you bringing to the table? So we have to change our way of thinking. Don't be worried about Sony buying CBS Records. As long as we have the Bruce Springsteens of the world, as long as we have the skills and the knowledge, as long as we are the ones who are at the cutting edge of the knowledge and skills and talents of the future, and I'll include talents because of our entertainment industry is brimming with talent. It's one of our major exports in the United States. As long as we have the skills and intelligence and talents of the future, we Americans will continue to prosper and thrive.
There's a growing gap between rich and poor in America. How does that figure into your view of the world economy?
It figures in directly, and it's of enormous concern. The problem is that while about 20% of Americans are doing very well competitively in the global economy because they have the skills and insights, they have the good education, they are the software engineers and the architects and the computer designers and the top managers and the lawyers and investment bankers, 80% of Americans are actually getting poorer. And the people at the very bottom, the bottom 20, are getting the poorest of all. There is a growing gap among Americans in terms of their take-home pay, and it's largely because of this global division of labor that I've been sketching for you. Because as the global market becomes ever more integrated, people who have the skills and talents have a larger and larger market for their skills and talents. Their wages and benefits go up. It's the law of supply and demand. But if you're unskilled, you are facing a world in which there are literally millions and millions of new people that you are competing with. By the same law of supply and demand, your wages inevitably are heading south. Well, what is America going to do about that? And this gets me back to my real concern, which is not Americans working for foreigners, not foreigners buying up America. No, that's not the problem. The real problem is we are not, as a nation, investing nearly enough in the education, training, health, and other capacities of the people who are less fortunate than the top 20%. And the top 20% have more than half of all the national income. They have the discretionary income to make a difference in terms of where the bottom half are going to go, the fate of the rest of the 80% of the population. And yet we have a very regressive tax system. We have a tax system that now essentially enables the rich to get ever richer and the poor to languish. Social Security payments are a good example that are now financing most of the federal government budget deficit.
Well, Robert Reich, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your views with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Terry.
Harvard economist Robert Reich. He's the author of several books, including The Next American Frontier and The Resurgent Liberal. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.